I've often said that in this business you have to be prepared for anything. Some of you know that it was only by accident that I learned that I'm on today. Didn't expect it quite this early. So, I've only got 10 pages to present. Usually it's 4. What that means is I didn't have time to boil it down to 4, the usual. So, I'll have to do some boiling as we go through this. We'll see. There might be cause for one. I should apologize first because what I'm going to present to you today is sort of dependent upon material that I've given to you in the past, and I'm going to presume that you understand certain things to a degree, going back as far as, let's say, the feast, the last great day in 05, where I presented the overall plan of God. And the outline of that is available if anyone wants to spend some time with it. It was very comprehensive as far as each of the various ages in which God is working with humanity. And then February of 06, we talked about, "And so all Israel shall be saved," showing that God's plan for Israel, even though he's blinded them for a time being, is to draw from them a greater response than would otherwise be had they all been called in this age. So we know that all of Israel is not called. Certain ones are, but also many Gentiles are called as well in this age. And then as recently as last December, we talked about understanding the three resurrections, and I presume that you're all familiar with the resurrections from the dead, and the outline of God's holy days that tie together with, or that meld together with this subject, because a great deal is revealed in God's holy days, and it has to do with the resurrections, or the resurrections have very much to do with them. And more recently, last February, we talked about the harvests of the world, showing how that God is going to ultimately give every person who ever lived one opportunity for salvation. We have many people from many ages who have gone to their graves totally unaware that there even was such a thing or would be such a thing. We have many people who are generally aware of religious teachings who still don't get it and don't have the capability in this age to be converted. God even says that of his own people, the Jewish people, who you would think are most likely to be eligible or to be good candidates for conversion, he has blinded them for a reason, and we'll get into that in a few minutes. But these are some of the basic shape of this that I want to lay out for you. What I'm going to go through is might be a little bit fast and furious. There is a copy floating around of the outline for today. If you want to take some time with it, you can. Also on the back table are some copies of recent articles, and it was those that I used to put together today's message. But I had to go on a trip the early part of this month, and just before going, I happened to wrap out 3 articles in a hurry just to get them on paper before I forgot what I was thinking about. And so those 3 are blended together into the message today. But in doing them, I saw a pattern that I hadn't particularly noticed before, but it sort of jumped out at me, and it's that pattern that I want to present. There have been at least 4 distinct, and I'm going to use the word dispensations, in history, have been or will be, that God is developing in harmony with his plan. The Protestants use that word dispensations in a little bit of a different context, and I don't want to color what I'm saying by using it, but I think it's safe enough to use it. The word dispensation referring to the outpouring of God's Spirit upon mankind in various levels or in various phases. It has not always been the same throughout history. Now we know in the ancient times, prior to Christ's sacrifice, that his Spirit, if available to anyone, was extremely limited. It involved people that God was specifically using for some activity to further his plan. The people who were called and who were converted and who were given God's Spirit in the age before the cross are very likely all named in the Bible. There may be that few. There could be more, we don't know. But the point is that God's Spirit was very, very limited in the ages past, or in the age prior to the time of Christ. But in what we call the Christian era, and I'll call that the second dispensation, at least as far as for purposes of this presentation, the second dispensation began with a very unusual event. And we celebrated that event once again just recently, the day of Pentecost, in which God's Spirit was visibly outpoured on a great number of people. Now keep in mind, those people were not asking for God's Spirit. They were there to observe a pre-existing biblical holy day without a clue as to what was going to happen. So what happened was largely a surprise to them. They weren't asking for God's Spirit, but it was poured out upon them in a very visible way to announce that the situation was changing. And then we see a few chapters later where a similar thing happened among a group of Gentiles. Again, a message in that the outpouring of God's Spirit was not limited, but was opening to a much greater degree than ever before. Now, that event that we read about in Acts chapter 2 regarding the Feast of Pentecost was an unusual event. That doesn't keep happening. But it did happen for the reason of to make mankind aware that the situation with respect to the outpouring of God's Spirit was changing. But even in the Christian era, we find something rather, let me use the word unusual as far as we would think of it, that even in the Christian era, the availability of God's Spirit is still very limited. And we're going to look at some verses that tell us that. They are limited to those things, to those people, God's Spirit is limited to those people whom the Father Himself specifically calls. There's a contrasting set of verses in the book of John, the Gospel of John, that we'll look at that pose a very interesting question. But let me continue with the outline first. This is the situation, so far as we know, from the time of Christ until His second coming, that the availability of God's Spirit is very limited. It's limited to those whom the Father specifically calls. And then the third dispensation would be that period of time during the millennium. And we're going to read some verses regarding that period of time in which God's Spirit is available on a much greater scale than ever before. And then the fourth dispensation is the post-millennial era. And this is an area where the world's religions are really unaware. Some acknowledge the millennium, but there is a post-millennial age. And in that, something really unusual happens. And we're going to read of it in the book of Ezekiel. But at that time, God says He is going to pour out His Spirit on an entire race of people who may or may not have even been asking for it. And it's that situation that is, I think, the most revealing of all about the business of receiving God's Spirit and how that relates to conversion. Receiving God's Spirit indicates that we are converted, but that's not the final word. Having God's Spirit doesn't mean we remain converted. We can lose it. And there's verses that address that subject very specifically. But we need to be aware of what God's Spirit is for and what it's doing. But in this, we see a pattern. In these four dispensations, we see a clear pattern that in each of them, God's Spirit is more and more and more available as time goes on. And that's the structure over which I want to overlay the content of what I have to present to you today. Hopefully it'll be organized enough where it'll make sense. But that's the general outline, and hopefully that much at least was clear to you. And if you want to study this subject further, there are three articles, the ones I referred to back, that are back on the table there. Whosoever will may come, and there's even a hymn in that hymnal in front of you that takes up on that line. The world's religions don't understand that period of time. We will in a minute. Another one's titled When God's Spirit is Poured Out, and that one refers to the revelation in Ezekiel 37. And the final one is Accessing God's Spirit. But in the book of John, there is what appears to be a very odd contradiction by Jesus himself. And we have to wonder, was he at all confused or contradictory, or what was this all about? In John 6:44, Jesus makes a very plain statement. He says, "No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day." Now that's reinforced by another couple of verses, verse 39 of the same chapter. "And this is the Father's will which has sent me, that of all which he has given me I should lose nothing, but I should raise it up again at the last day." And verse 65 of the same chapter. "And he said, Therefore I said I unto you that no man can come unto me except it were given unto him of my Father." In this age, being called of God, in reality, it's not our choice. If anyone is called in this age, and if anyone receives God's Spirit in this age, we know something has happened. That God the Father has specifically nominated you to his Son for conversion. That's not true of all men. But then we have this other passage over in John chapter 7, just a few pages over, verses 36 and 7. Starting in the middle of the verse, he says, "If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believes on me, as the scriptures have said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living waters." And that verse has a very close parallel to chapter 22 of the book of Revelation, Revelation 22:17, where it says, "The Spirit and the bride say, Come. And let him that heareth say, Come. And let him that is athirst come," speaking of those same waters that we read about in John 7. "And whosoever will, let him take of the water of life freely." We can see a very close parallel between these two verses in John 7 and Revelation 22. But it seems that that contradicts what was said earlier in chapter 6 of the Gospel of John, that no man can come to me unless the Father which has sent me draw him. How do we resolve the contradiction, or the apparent contradiction? Well, there's something that we need to know about the book of John, and I think it's been mentioned before. But the Gospel of John was written later than the others. And John recognized that there was something that needed to be added to the narrative of the other three Gospels. If you read the book of John carefully, you will realize that John moves from one holy day season to another holy day season. Each of his narrative segments are focused around one of the holy day seasons in Jesus' life. And if you want a good expose of this, read that Harmony of the Gospels that Fred Coulter has put out. And I think many of you have that. But he makes a good case for that. But in the book of John, he goes from holy day to holy day, with only one exception. There's one place where he talks about the Feast of Dedication, which is not an Old Testament biblical holy day. It was a traditional one. Not to diminish it any, but it just wasn't one of the seven. But all the rest of the narrative is related to a biblical holy day. Now, if we take those two apparently contradictory statements of Jesus himself, the one in John 6 and the one in John 7, and if we look at the holy day context in which they were given, we begin to get an answer. In John 6, it has to do with, or the era is, the springtime holy days. But in John 7, it's up to that period of time, and it's even specifically mentioned, the last great day. In fact, it's from this passage only that we even have a name for the last great day. It isn't named anywhere else in the Bible. But let's look at that passage a little more carefully, because there's something in it that's very revealing. Starting in the early part of chapter 7, after these things Jesus walked in Galilee, for he would not walk in Jewry, because the Jews sought to kill him. Now the Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. So this section in chapter 7 is related to the fall holy day season. His brethren therefore said unto him, Depart hence, and go into Judea, that thy disciples also may see the works that you do. But down in verse 6 he said unto them, My time is not yet come, but your time is always ready. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me, because I testify of it that the works thereof are evil. You go up to the feast. I will not go up yet unto this feast, for my time is not yet full come. Long story short, he snuck in sometime during the feast, but unannounced. Verse 10, But when his brethren were gone up, he then went up also unto the feast, not openly, but as it were in secret. Over in verse 14, Now about the midst of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and taught. But then when we get down to verse 36 and 7, and why? Do I have the wrong reference? There it is, of course. Hidden in plain sight, always is. Thank you. In the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood and cried, saying, If any man thirst, let him come unto me and drink. He that believes on me, as the Scriptures have said, out of his belly shall flow rivers of living water. This statement was made in the context of the last great day. And that's why the picture that he presents is very different from his earlier statement in John chapter 6. John chapter 6 relates more to the situation in what I call the second dispensation, the Christian era. But in verse 37 and 8, the statement that he makes relates more to the millennial age and the post-millennial age. And that's the important distinction. You see, this era right now, even though if you listen to the Protestant religions, they would all claim that it is, but this era right now is not the period which we could call whosoever will. Anyone who comes and who receives God's Spirit and who is truly converted in this age has been specifically called by God the Father. And that's an important distinction we need to make. The opportunity is not wide open to humanity as a rule. That time comes later, beginning with Christ's return. So that, I hope, will explain the difference between the two statements, the one in John chapter 6 and the one in John chapter 7. In Matthew 13, we get a little bit more of a glimpse of the situation in this second dispensation, Matthew chapter 13, around verse 10. Where it says, "And the disciples came and said unto him, Why do you speak to them in parables? And he answered and said unto them, Because it is given unto you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it's not given. For whosoever has, to him shall be given, and he shall have more abundance." And this is talking about spiritual things. "But whosoever has not, from him shall be taken away even what little he may have. Therefore speak I unto them." That's why I speak to them in parables, because they, seeing, see not. They really don't see it. They really don't get it. "And hearing, they hear not, neither do they understand. And in them is fulfilled the prophecy of Isaiah, which says, By hearing you shall hear and shall not understand, and seeing you shall see and shall not perceive. For this people's heart is waxed gross, and their ears are dull of hearing. And their eyes they have closed, lest at any time they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and should understand with their heart and should be converted, and I should heal them." God's plan was not to call all people at this time. Here is a major segment of people who are seeking him out, who he is still leaving in the dark. They may understand certain things, but not enough. Mark 4:11 repeats basically the same thing. Luke 8:10, another place. In Luke 8:10 it says, "And he said, Unto you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of God, but to others in parables, that seeing they might see, and hearing they might not understand." They might not see and might not understand. Not God's intent to call his people at this point in time. The Apostle Paul recognized the fact. And he had a lot to say regarding this. In Romans 11, verse 7, responding to the question of why isn't all of Israel converted, you would think they would be the prime candidates. And Paul says, "What then?" in verse 7. "Israel has not obtained that which he seeks for, but the election has obtained it, and the rest were blinded." In verse 8, "According as it is written, God has given them the spirit of slumber, eyes that they should not see, and ears that they should not hear unto this day. And David says, Let their table be made a snare and a trap and a stumbling block and a recompense unto them. Let their eyes be darkened that they may not see." This is a God-imposed veil over their understanding. "I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall?" And here's what Paul understood, and it's what we need to understand. "God forbid, but rather through their fall, salvation is come unto the Gentiles. Not because the Gentiles are better people, because it factors into God's plan to draw a greater response from his people." And that's what Paul meant when he said, "For to provoke them to jealousy." Israelites, and I'm not talking about Jews, Israelites of all stripes, have this attitude thing. They have this pride thing. And when the lowly, or when the despised, or when the pagans come out better than we are, what do you think the response is? They're going to knuckle down. They're going to try harder. They were beaten out by so-called inferior. "To provoke them to jealousy. For I would not, brethren, that you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceits," referring to that attitude, "that blindness in part has happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in." There's a time frame worked into this. "For God has concluded them all in unbelief." God did it. Why? "That he might have mercy upon all." God has imposed blindness on what we would regard as likely candidates for a simple reason. It is his intention to reap from that group of people the greatest number of people that he possibly can. And the best way to do that is to defer their calling unto a better age. And that would be that third dispensation. Actually, the fourth. The third for those who live over on into that period of time, and the fourth for those who have already died prior to it beginning. But that is the whosoever will period. At that point in time, after Christ's return, into the millennial age, the opportunity for salvation will be wide open. Let's look at Ezekiel 37. I've referred to it a number of times. It's about time we went there. As you know, these last 12 chapters of the book of Ezekiel refer mostly to the millennial age. They describe what the millennial kingdom and the millennial worship system will be like. But in chapter 37, he gives us a glimpse into that fourth dispensation, that period of time that we refer to as the second resurrection era, which we expect will be at least one full generation long. We don't know exactly how long. Probably doesn't matter how long. The point is, it is of sufficient time to give those people who never had an opportunity their opportunity. But in chapter 37, he presents a number of interesting things. And this is talking about the Valley of Dry Bones, and I'm going to skip through this. I presume you're familiar with it. But I want to call out certain key statements here. In verse 11, "Then he said unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel." The whole house. This isn't talking about Jews. The Protestants think these are Jews only. No. The whole house of Israel. "Behold, they say, our bones are dried and our hope is lost. We are cut off for our parts." And that's interesting that they would be concerned about such a thing as political division. You'll see what that term, our parts, refers to as we get further down here. "Therefore prophesy and say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, O my people, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves and bring you into the land of Israel. And you shall know that I am the Lord when I have opened your graves, O my people, and brought you up out of your graves." A resurrection. "And shall put my spirit in you, and you shall live. And I shall place you in your own land, and then shall you know that I, the Lord, have spoken it and performed it, says the Lord." Very potent passage of Scripture, a very interesting prophecy. But then he goes on to say more. "The word of the Lord came again unto me, saying, moreover, thou son of man, take thee one stick and write upon it for Judah," that's the Jewish peoples, "and for the children of Israel, his companions." And there's another tribe with the Jews besides just Judah. "And take another stick and write upon it for Joseph," the leading tribe of that section of the nation called Israel, "the stick of Ephraim, and for all the house of Israel and his companions, and join them one to another into one stick, and they shall become one in thine hand." What had been two separate nations, what had been two separate and diverse peoples, are going to be rejoined as one nation. And we have to wonder why. At this point in time, if this were the resurrection to sentencing, if this was the end, why would he bother to do this? "And when the children of thy people shall speak unto you, saying, will thou show us what you mean by this? Say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the stick of Joseph with his in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribe of Israel and his fellows, and will put them with him, even with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they shall be one in mine hand. And the sticks wherein thou writest shall be in thine hand before their eyes. We're talking about national unity, something they haven't seen since shortly after the death of King Solomon. All these years, the two peoples have been separate. Verse 21, and say unto them, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will take the children of Israel from among the heathen, whether they be gone, and I will gather them on every side and bring them into their own land. And I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. And one king shall be king to them all, and they shall be no more two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more at all. How does the Protestant world process that? Neither shall they defile themselves any more with their idols, nor with their detestable things, nor with any of their transgressions. But I will save them out of their dwelling places wherein they have sinned, and I will cleanse them. So shall they be my people, and I will be their God. And David, my servant, shall be king over them. And again, asking the question, if this were a sentencing event, why bother doing that? The suggestion of David being king over them tells us that there is going to be a period of time in for which that to happen. And the next phrase basically says that. They shall also walk in my judgments and observe my statutes and do them. They're going to have time to be able to do them. But the key thing is what we saw back over in verse 14. And I shall put my spirit in you, and you shall live. These are people, for the most part, who are going to be raised up out of their graves, who are going to be given God's spirit, and it doesn't even necessarily say they were asking for it any more than the people on the day of Pentecost. They didn't even know what was coming. These people are going to, peoples of Israel, and I'm not saying all nations, this is specifically the peoples of Israel, are going to be given God's Spirit outright. It's going to be poured upon them. And it's going to be not automatic conversion. And that's the picture we might get, but we have to think about this carefully. It's not automatic conversion. They're given God's Spirit, and we can say they are quasi-converted, but they still have to work through the process just the same as we do today. The gift of God's Spirit is not automatic conversion. It is conversion. But we still have to work through the program. And so will they. It'll be a sink or swim situation. The entire nation of Israel, apparently bar none, will have God's Spirit given to them upon being resurrected. And think what that will do for their perception level. They'll be able to see and understand things that they never saw before. Right off the bat. But then they're going to have to knuckle down. And like I say, sink or swim. Either they're going to carry through their conversion fully to the end, or they're going to lose it. And then, after that, comes the sentencing that is appropriate to their situation. Those who make it, of course, are brought into are added to the book of life and brought into the family of God as progeny of the bride and Jesus. That's the age in which God's Spirit will be poured out practically without limit. But the people are still going to have to work through the program just the same as any other physical human being has at whatever time they were called. But that's what I find to be the interesting thing about this, that God's Spirit, though limited in this age, as time goes on, as we move through God's plan, God's Spirit is increasingly available to greater numbers of people with greater ease. And that may be a comfort in one respect. It may answer some questions with regard to why aren't more people converted right now. Let me say it this way. God has called the people that He knows can make it. I'm not saying you will. That's up to you. That's up to each of us. But He has called the people and is calling the people in this age who He knows can make it. And I would say that he is not calling the people that he knows probably wouldn't. For the simple reason, he wants to give them an opportunity later, in a better age, when Satan is restrained. He's going to be restrained for 1,000 years. That's the same 1,000 years as the millennial age. Satan is going to be positively and powerfully removed from an entire millennium. And those people who live in that time, if they don't make it, it's their own fault. But they're going to have the opportunity. Whosoever will in the millennial age may come. It doesn't say that of this present age. It says that of the millennial age, and specifically and especially the last great day. That's where that statement, whosoever will, applies. So what Jesus said was not self-contradictory. It is true that in this age, those who come are those who are specifically nominated of the Father. Think about that. God knows, God the Father knows you personally by name. He knows that you are able to make it. Question is, do you want to badly enough, and will you? And that's what each of us needs to work through in our minds. This is our opportunity, which is another scary thing. We don't have those future ages to look forward to. Those who are called now are very much obligated to follow through, to carry through now. So the burden is more upon us in that respect, we who are called here in the second dispensation. In the third, it goes into a whosoever will situation. And that carries through to the end of time with respect to Gentile peoples. But as we get into the fourth, Israel, the entire nation of Israel, who is raised, who is given God's Spirit, who is given King David to rule over them for the remainder of their days, he himself a spirit being at that point in time, we expect David will be in the first resurrection. And he will have the millennial age to learn how to be that they need. And then when the post-millennial age begins, he's going to be given that assignment to rule over the resurrected Israel who have God's Spirit. And think of what David, a man after God's own heart, who has been trained leading the physical nations of Israel, the survivors, who lived over into the millennial age, think what he can do for those people raised in the fourth dispensation. So I call it a very interesting story. God has a plan for calling all mankind. That plan involves the availability to of or the access to his Spirit. We have that access right now, not because of any greatness of our own, but simply because God the Father, in his wisdom, knows that we can make it. And he wouldn't be calling those that he suspects couldn't. So it's kind of profound when you think about it. The level of privilege that we have to be called in this age. And this calling, of course, to us means being part of the bride of Christ. We talked about that a long time ago when we looked at the Passover and the bride subject. Where on Passover, Jesus proposed marriage to those people who would ultimately become his bride. I want to go to a passage. I passed over it, and maybe I shouldn't have. I think I mentioned it. I've lost my place in my notes, so it's the one where the Spirit and the Bride say, come. I think that's in Revelation 22. I'll just shoot from the hip here for a minute. Oh, my eyes fell right on it. Look at that, 22:17. Because there's a hidden significance in the way this is worded, and I think we ought to make note of that as well. But in chapter 22, verse 17, "And the Spirit and the bride say, Come. And let him that hears say, Come. And let him that is athirst come. And whosoever will, let him take of the water of life freely." The primary people, or the primary individuals, putting out this offer of whosoever will, is the Spirit and the bride. At this point in time, the bride of Christ will have been with him for 1,000 years. Or will be beginning the 1,000 years, I'm sorry. When this whosoever will period opens up, the Spirit, Jesus Christ, and his bride will be working the program to extend a salvation to all those people who are alive in that age. They will become the progeny of Jesus and his bride. So it's significant that the bride is mentioned here, because that keys us into the point in time. And of course, you read the rest of the context around this chapter, you'll realize that this is the very end. This is the open door to the receipt of God's Spirit that is there, that is possible. And the administration of that Spirit is going to be the head family of God. Those who are raised in the first resurrection, who are reigning with him, his bride, they are the ones that are going to be instrumental in bringing in the others. That's the environment that is going to be there. That's the spiritual leadership structure, if I can use that term, that's going to exist at the time when the millennial age opens, and that's going to extend clear on through to the very end. But I think it adds a great deal to the picture with respect to our personal calling to see this overview, to see how that God's Spirit is going to be made available in increasing increments, very carefully parsed out in the first, selectively available in the second, whosoever will in the third, and whosoever will, coupled with all of Israel being, let me use the word, force-fed God's Spirit without their even having asked for it, in the fourth. With that, I think we can understand and appreciate a little better the outpouring of God's Spirit that we saw in the Feast of Pentecost. If anything, that is an alarm bell that tells us that the situation is changing. It has changed already to a certain degree, but it's going to change again when Christ returns. Something we should be aware of, it's a side issue, but let's look at it. We've got a minute. It's found in Revelation chapter... Oh boy. I'm too far from my notes. I'll have to fish for it. It's a place that says, where God begins to deal with the humanity remaining alive at the end time. Remember, chapter 20 talks about an angel coming down from heaven, having the key of the bottomless pit and a great chain in his hand, and he laid hold upon the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years. This is chapter 20 of Revelation. Verse 4, "And I saw thrones, and they sat upon them, and judgment was given unto them." We spoke about that earlier, about Christ and his bride are going to be the world rulers at that time. "And I saw the souls of them that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus," this is verse 4, "and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received his mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. But the rest of the dead lived not again till 1,000 years were finished." That we know. when the rest of the dead are raised, begins that fourth dispensation. Now, the place that I want is where he commands the worship. It may be earlier than I thought. Yeah, this is it. It's in chapter 14. This is talking about the 144,000. And I looked, and lo, a lamb stood on the mountain, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written in their foreheads. That's verse 1 of chapter 14. Down to verse 6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, unto every nation and kindred and tongue and people. This is the beginning of the millennial age. I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people, saying with a loud voice, Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment is come. And worship Him that made heaven and earth, and the sea, and the fountains of waters. Worship the Creator. How do you worship the Creator? By commemorating His creation, which is one of the things that we do by keeping His Sabbath. This is the message going out to the rest of humanity. Not those in the ruling class. This is the physical survivors. Worship Him who made. God is going to open the plan. He's going to open the minds of all of those who live in the millennial age, clear through to the end. But they're going to be given the choice of either worshiping God or not. There's not going to be some other God to worry about. There'll only be one God, the true God, not any that men have created on their own. If I find it, I got one more thing I would like to present with respect to that passage that we read in Ezekiel 37. Pardon me while I fish here. Result of being horribly disorganized. Here it is. And I asked the question when we were reading Ezekiel 37, what's the point of giving those people time? What's the point of resurrecting them, putting His Spirit in them, of reuniting the nation, of putting them under King David? If this were just a sentencing event, it isn't just a sentencing event. It's an opportunity for them to continue living the physical lives that they would otherwise have had they been converted in their first lifetimes. But there's a number of things that we can glean from that passage, and I should have pointed this out earlier. First of all, that they will be all resurrected together. Secondly, the state of their existence will be physical. That they will be reunified as a nation. Fourth thing, that they will again be restored to the true worship of their true God. Fifth, that their prevalent religious practices are detestable. God says that of them, and we read the same thing here in Revelation 14. The sixth thing, God will place His Spirit within them, a condition not seen at any time prior. There is no point in history where we can say that prophecy was fulfilled. It is certainly future. Seventh thing, they will be sanctified nationally. They will become the model nation they should have been all along. Point eight, God's sanctuary will be among them. And another interesting thing, point nine, the unconverted will be living among them and will bear witness of this. And to that we could add a 10, that they will all become acutely aware of their ethnic identities as descendants of the tribes of Israel, something that they don't have presently. In fact, a teaching that they reject presently because of some embarrassing conclusions that we could make with regard to God's law if they were the peoples of Israel. Another subject, another day. But all of these things tell us that Israel, resurrected Israel, is going to see God's Spirit poured out upon them without restriction whatsoever. And it's appropriate at that time. It's their last chance. And they've been denied the chance in the fact that God has blinded them to a great degree. We read many of those scriptures, and there's many more to read, where God has veiled their understanding. He has blinded them lest they should see. And he says for the specific reason that a greater number should ultimately be saved. So we can see in these four dispensations the increasing outflow of God's Spirit to His creation. God is not willing that any should perish. And He also has a plan that's consistent with that will. We need to understand the picture that we see in the biblical holy days. We need to understand the resurrections. Those are important. All of this fits together in the implementation of God's plan to ultimately make His Spirit available to all who have ever lived. But think about the privilege that we have to be called in this age, because at some point in time, God the Father uttered your name to His Son.